Chapter 11. Sarah and I get our first chance to talk together at school the next day. The FBI, in a rare moment of kindness, didn't inform Sarah's parents about the events of Saturday night, so for all they knew, Sarah had just been out way past her curfew and got caught up in the attempt to catch wanted criminal John Smith. As part of her punishment, she's on a strict schedule, one that includes bus rides to and from Helena High and no more quality time with me. It's a bummer, but it'll pass. I'm waiting near the entryway of the school, pretending to be interested in reading a book for English class when she arrives. We lock eyes, and I motion my head towards the deserted hallway that leads to the back of the school's auditorium. "Hey," she says. She seems in good spirits, which is a vast improvement over the last time we spoke. "Hey yourself," I say. "How you holding up?" "I'm on complete parental lockdown right now, but other than that, I'm okay." She looks away from me. No word from you-know-who. I wouldn't worry about that. From what I can gather, they made a clean getaway. And then I realize what she means. John escaped, but didn't contact her. He didn't come back for her. "Oh, but I'm sure he's thinking about you." It's by far more of a question than a statement. "It's cool. I've had a lot of time to think it over while barricaded in my room. Of course he didn't come for me. It's not like I can just leave my family and go gallivanting across the world fighting aliens or whatever it is he's doing. And dropping by again to see me just puts me in danger. I'm sure when the time is right he'll come back for me." "Great." It's possible that a part of me was hoping that this whole questioned by the FBI about my arrested boyfriend thing would snap some sense into Sarah. Looks like I've got more waiting to do. "I just wish there was some way we could figure out what their next move is." Something clicks in the back of my head. I see a way for me and Sarah to spend some time together. "You've got no absences in art after lunch, right?" I ask.
"Right."
Her voice has a hint of suspicion in it. "It's only our second week here." "Good. We're going to try to gather some intel." Her face scrunches in confusion. I smirk. "An explosion at the Goods house the same night John's in town? Can't be a coincidence, can it?" "Of course not," she says. Her lips start to morph into a mischievous smile. "That's not something that you can sleep through. I'll bet Mrs. Goods saw some stuff. Maybe she even got to talk to Sam. I mean, you know she's been worried about him. Maybe he gave her some idea about where they were going."
"And what do we do about our class?"
I shrug. "We had a flat tire at lunch. You're allowed a few unexcused absences. Where's your sense of adventure, Sarah Bleeding Heart?" She lets out a laugh. "Don't you dare tell me I'm trying to lead a boring life." At lunch, we leave hell and travel back to paradise. Sam's house is on the outskirts of town, and I stick to all the back roads I can. The last thing I need right now is to run into my dad when I'm supposed to be lifting weights 20 minutes away. We ring the doorbell a few times and loiter on the porch, but no one's around. I peer through the front windows and some lacy curtains, but there don't appear to be any lights on inside. After 5 minutes, we make our way around the back of the house, where I see exactly why the police rushed out to the Goods place. Half the backyard is scorched. It looks like a little well or something has been blasted to pieces. There's a huge window that's been blown out and covered with some kind of plastic tarp. It gives me sudden flashbacks of the way the campus looked during the Moog attack.
"They were definitely here," Sarah says, coming up beside me.
"There's no evidence of this being other than a fire, though. No weapons or anything like that. Everything must have been taken away."
"The cleanup crew is thorough."
I nod, and we walk over to the truck, defeated. I'm ready to drive back to Helena when Sarah sees it.
"Mark," she whispers.
She's pointing at something in the passenger side mirror. We turn in tandem, and I immediately see what's caught her eye. There's a black car parked in the middle of the road about a football field away, unmoving. The windshield is so tinted that I can't even tell if anyone's inside or not.
"That car," I start. "Doesn't look friendly,"
Sarah finishes my thought. I put my truck in gear and start driving, my eyes locked on the rearview mirror, hoping that the car will stay put.
It doesn't.
Mark,
Sarah says, I know. My foot presses harder on the gas. I tell myself this is just a coincidence, but there's no way I can talk my brain into believing that.
It's gaining on us, Sarah says.
She's completely twisted around in the seat, her hands gripping the headrest. I glance down at my speedometer. I'm already going 60 in a 30, but I speed up even more.
Shit!
Sarah shouts, and I look in my rearview mirror again just in time to see the front bumper of the car disappear under my tailgate. The car gives me a fairly light love tap, probably not enough to cause any damage, but enough for me to feel it and to rattle me pretty hard. It lets up a little, but it's still trailing me by only a few feet. Instinctively, I speed up. The car does the same.
Get back under your seatbelt!
I yell at Sarah, who's wiggled out of it to keep her eyes locked on the car.
What do we do?
She asks. My mind races. I can't slow down. Luckily, the street we're on is fairly straight, but there's a curve coming up I'll never be able to take at this speed. I don't know, I mutter. I'm pushing 90 and rising, but the car's not letting up. I can barely make out someone behind the wheel, just a big black blob vaguely in the shape of a human. I wonder for a second if it's a Moog or an FBI agent or some new type of alien we didn't even know existed, because that's a very real possibility at this point.
What do they want?
I ask.
Obviously to murder us,
Sarah shouts. She grips her seat. We're approaching the curve in the road when the car suddenly zips into the oncoming traffic lane and revs up beside me until we're speeding along parallel to one another. The tinting on the car windows make it impossible to see anything but the reflection of the outside world, like the car is some sort of automated machine out for blood without an actual driver inside. Sarah gasps,
Crap, it's going to...
I see what she's guessing at a split second before it happens. I slam on my brakes. Sarah screams. The black car whips into my lane, missing the hood of my truck by what looks like inches. I can feel my anti-lock brakes pumping beneath my foot as the bed of my truck starts to slide to the right.
Hold on!
I shout, bracing myself with one hand on the wheel and gripping Sarah's arm, as if I'm going to be able to hold us in place if we start to roll. I can feel the truck start to fall over. But we don't roll. The truck tips, then shudders, and finally comes to a stop after spinning a quarter turn. Smoke from my tires drifts through the air around us, filling my nose with the stench of burned rubber. Every muscle in my body is contracted, and I can already tell that I'm going to have some kind of bruise where my body's been thrown against the seatbelt. There's no sign of the black car. It's disappeared around the curve.
Are you okay?
I ask Sarah, who looks at me and nods. Her hair has been thrown over her face and her eyes are wide. She wriggles a little and I realize I've got a vice-like grip on her. I let her go. My fingers feel stiff. I put the truck into park and start to shake a little, adrenaline rushing through me. Ahead of us, the black car appears, stopped at the head of the curve in the road.
Mark,
Sarah says,
get us out of here.
And then there's smoke coming from the car's wheels as it peels out. It careens straight for the passenger side of my truck. I flip the truck into reverse to try to get us off the road, but I'm too slow. There's no way we're getting out of the way in time. And then, at the last second, the car swerves to the right and misses us completely, then continues to barrel down the deserted road as I stomp on the gas and back up as fast as possible. I end up slamming into a thin, tall tree. It falls over with a crack, splintering. We watch as the car disappears from sight again, this time miles and miles away. I'm breathing like I've just played the most intense scrimmage of my life. Sarah's hands are shaking.
What the fuck was that?
I ask.
I think that means we were poking around where we weren't supposed to. That car just tried to kill us.
No, Sarah says, shaking her head. It was just trying to scare us, to warn us about what would happen if we keep digging, if we get more involved. I glance at the clock. The period after lunch is starting in Helena. Shakily, I put the truck in gear and head towards our new school. There's nothing else for us in paradise right now.
Chapter 12. My dad's already home by the time I get back from school that night, which is strange because he's recently been getting home about an hour after I do. I back my truck around the side of the house. There's a good-sized dent in my bumper and some scraped paint on my tailgate that I'd like to hide from as long as possible. Stupid tree. I can hear fighting when I walk inside. I rush to the dining room where Nana's reprimanding Dad about something. There are several cans of beer on the table. I walk in on him mid-sentence.
Bastards have no right to kick me out of my own damned office.
You may be an adult, Nana says, but you won't use language like that under my roof.
They notice me at the same time, and Nana moves to usher me out of the dining room while my dad swigs back a beer.
What's going on? I ask.
Apparently the FBI has completely taken over your father's station,
Nana says, pushing me into the kitchen and pointing at a plate of cookies. I shake my head.
What? He's less than pleased. Apparently a man named Purdy or Purdy or some such kicked him out of his own office.
Purdy. How can they even do that? I ask.
Nana just shrugs.
I wouldn't ask him right now if I were you. Let's give him some space.
I nod. I've seen my dad drink beer all my life, but I'm not sure I've ever seen him day drinking like this, or even actually drunk, so I head upstairs to put my stuff away and check in on what I've missed online during the drive home from Helena while trying to figure out why the FBI might have taken over the police station. The logical part of me says that it's just because John's escaped, and they're concerned he's going to come back here, but there's also a nagging thought in the back of my mind. Does this have anything to do with the fact that I was digging around at the goods today? Is this another FBI warning? One more subtle than a car trying to run me off the road, but definitely more personal. I shake my head. This has got to be about the search for John and Six. That's what I have to believe. I'm bummed Sarah's not online to chat with. I want to tell her about these new developments, but now that her cell is gone and her parents are wardens of the landline, the internet's my only way of communicating with her. When I see she's not there, I email her, telling her I've got some news she'll want to hear but don't actually mention anything specific. Later that night, when my dad is passed out watching reruns in the recliner downstairs, I get a text from a weird number I don't recognize. Hi. Have you heard of any sightings of John? I guess Sarah got a new phone after all. Hopefully a burner. I text her back. No. I think that's good, though. A few seconds pass, and I get a response. Yeah, I guess. I just wish we could help more. I sigh and text back. We're doing all we can. Can you call me? I have stuff to tell you. And then, nothing. I lie on the fold-out couch with my phone on my chest, waiting to feel it vibrate as I stare at the ceiling. I try to work things out in my head. The FBI has basically taken over paradise. They're working for the Moogs, or at least aren't on the Lorix side of things. And earlier today, some crazy person tried to kill me and Sarah, or just scare us badly enough that we'd stop poking around. But I can't stop digging. Can't just go back to the way things were before everything went nuts at the school. Which means that things could get even more dangerous for me and for Sarah. I start to wonder what my family would do if I just disappeared one day. If the FBI or Moogs took me, what would the editors of the blog think? Would all the research and fact-finding I've tried to do have been for nothing? After a while, I pull my computer to the bed and start typing up everything I can remember about the Moogs from the attack on the school. It's part eyewitness account, part profile on the evil aliens. I don't want to forget any details, and it may come in handy one day if we ever have to try to explain to people what really happened that night, or how to fight the Moogs, or if I get in over my head and suddenly disappear. I leave the document saved as a private draft on the blog, unsure of what to do with it. Posting it will just send the FBI after me, or the Moogs. They'd probably show up in the middle of the night and gut me with their glowing weapons. It's not a pleasant thought, which is probably why I have a terrible dream once I finally go to bed. It starts off great, one of those dreams where it seems so mundane at first that there's no question that what you're seeing is reality. Sarah and I are in an old cabin that my family used to vacation at up in Michigan, one that I don't think I've been to since I was 12 years old. We're sitting in the room I always used to claim as my own. The one with two twin beds that were covered with these amazing electric blankets that I'd refused to get out from under on cold mornings.
But it's not cold in the dream. In fact, it feels like spring, everything bathed in this peaceful, golden light. Sarah's on one of the twin beds and I'm on the other, and we're just talking. She's saying something about an upcoming cheerleading competition, and I'm telling her she'll be perfect. And she's smiling so much. We're both so happy. The dream is filled with happiness, like it's in the air we're breathing. And then there's a noise outside. I look through the window and see a huge beast, one of the creatures that attacked the school. A Moog monster, all yellow eyes and claws and horns. It's coming right for us. I turn away and go to grab Sarah, but she's gone. Moog soldiers have poured into the room, their swords glowing different colors. They're all grinning this sick grin, showing off their gray teeth. One of them has Sarah. She reaches out and calls my name. I step towards her. And then something juts out of her chest right where her heart is, something long and sharp and glowing. Sarah screams, her eyes go wide, and then her body goes slack, and then she's gone. Her body turns to ash and blows away as if she were an alien. It's my own shout that wakes me up, sweating in the upstairs office. I text Sarah on the new number, but she doesn't answer. She must be asleep. At some point, I pass out again, because the next thing I know, light is filtering in through the windows, and I can smell bacon cooking downstairs. I'm a little disoriented, but head to the bathroom and brush my teeth and stuff before meeting Nana in the kitchen.
"Your father's still asleep up in his room," she says with a bit of an edge to her voice. "Probably will be for a while, and he'll wake up in a crappy mood." She smirks a little. "Serves him right."
I grab a slice of bacon from the ever-growing stack she's got going beside the stove and devour half of it in one bite. "He'll be okay, right?" I ask.
"Oh, of course. The James men have always just been a stubborn brood."
Nana raises a white eyebrow towards me.
"You're no exception."
I act hurt, as if she's wounded me with some imaginary bullet. She chuckles to herself. Then there's a knock on the door. She gives me a questioning look, but I just shake my head. She sighs.
"They'll be for your father, I bet."
She looks down at her apron, which is smudged with grease. "I'll stall them," I say. "You go get him up. He won't yell at you as much." She pats me on the shoulder and walks away. I shove the rest of the bacon slice into my mouth and head for the front door, expecting to find Todd or one of Dad's deputies. Instead, I open the door and see Agent Walker. At the foot of the porch, Agent Noto stands tall, with his hands clasped in front of him. My face must register my surprise, because Agent Walker raises a hand in front of her chest as if to calm me down.
"What do you want?" I ask, not trying to hide the anger in my voice. For all I know, it was these two who tried to run me and Sarah off the road yesterday.
"Calm down, Mr. James," Walker says. She frowns. "We're only here to ask you a few questions. I'm sure you are. Mr. James, Mark, it's imperative that you tell us anything you know about what Sarah Hart was doing after school yesterday."
"Why should I tell you anything?" I ask.
"Because Sarah never made it home last night," Walker says.
There's a silence that settles over the porch. I can't tell if I'm imagining it, or if it's just being caused by the sudden pounding in my ears.
What do you mean?"
I manage to stammer.
"Her parents filed a report last night," Walker explains. "Since Ms. Hart is a person of interest, we're bypassing the normal waiting period required to declare someone a missing person and jumping straight into the investigation. So, I ask you again, Mark, what did Sarah do after school yesterday?"
I shake my head.
"None of this makes sense. I talked to her last night. She texted me. She..."
The text, from a number I didn't recognize. It could have been anyone. A voice keeps repeating in my head. "Sarah's gone. Sarah's gone."
"Nothing,"
I say. I mean, I don't know. I haven't talked to her since lunch yesterday. She took the bus home. Agent Walker nods. She seems satisfied with this answer. For a moment, her face changes, like some kind of mask slips away, and she looks at me with concern, maybe even pity, as if she wished she could do something for me, maybe even give me a hug. But the moment passes, and her steely expression resurfaces, her mouth with a glued-on smile. "We'll be in touch," she says, turning away from the door. And then she's gone into one of the ubiquitous black SUVs that have flooded our town. Sarah's gone. I failed to protect her. What am I supposed to do now? No, that's an easy question to answer. I find her. But how am I supposed to do that? Chapter 13. It takes a while for me to realize that John might have come for her, and so I sit glued to my computer and check my phone every 2 minutes, hoping that she'll send me some sort of message telling me she's all right. She must know that I'm going out of my mind, and she'll let me know she's safe. Days pass without any word from her, and I realize I'm holding on to unfounded hope. If she was with John, she would have found a way to contact me. She wouldn't have just left me behind. It's so easy for me to look at the day she disappeared and see the things I should have done. When she, or whoever it was, texted me from that strange number. I shouldn't have ever even left her alone after what happened at Sam's house with the black car. I feel like an idiot. I feel useless. I have to do something. I'm practically glued to the blog, but there's only so much research I can do online. I can't just sit around and do nothing. I'll go crazy. Something dings in the back of my head. Sarah saying that Sam probably knew more about what was happening with the Lorik and the Moogs than any of us. His backyard was a battleground. His mom is probably scared not staying at the house. The back window has been blown out, covered only by a sheet of plastic. It would be the easiest thing in the world to climb through it. If Sam had a better idea of what was happening between the Moogs and the Lorik, maybe he left behind some clues I can use. It's almost 2 a.m. when I sneak downstairs dressed in all black clothes, cringing at every creaking step. No one wakes up to stop me except for the dogs, but I've prepared for them. A few pieces of beef jerky, and Abby and Dozer are as quiet as can be. I keep my headlights off until I'm already on the road. I drive past Sam's house a few times to see if I can spot anyone around it, but it doesn't look like someone's home. I park a few houses away, just in case. There's no car out front, and a quick peek in the garage tells me there's no car in there either. I knock just to make sure that no one answers. It's dead quiet inside. Bingo. Empty house. I take a deep breath and psych myself up. I've snuck in and out of a few houses in my life, but I've never actually done any breaking and entering. I tell myself it's no big deal, and I need to do this. Any info I get helps us. Any info I get helps me get closer to finding Sarah. I push in the plastic and climb through the window in the backyard and end up in the dining room. It's not hard to tell which room is Sam's, the one with a sign that says, "Enter at your own risk." I cross the brown carpet covering the hallway and slip inside. Sam's room is covered in posters that remind me why we all thought he was a weirdo at school. Star Wars, aliens, Starship Troopers, and at least 2 different NASA flags. I imagine that wherever he is right now, he's wearing the same old ratty NASA t-shirt. After bumping my head against a bunch of painted balls hanging from the middle of his ceiling, I start looking around. I'm not sure where to begin my search, so I just kind of start moving things on his desk. The problem is, I could point anywhere in Sam's room and my finger would land on something out of the ordinary. I sift through action figures, blurry pictures of the sky, and a telescope it looks like he was trying to repair. I accidentally break the arm off a model robot and feel bad for about a split second before I remember that Sam's off somewhere with John and probably doesn't even remember that the model exists. Finally, I come across something that gets my attention. I take a seat in Sam's desk chair and open up a copy of a little magazine called They Walk Among Us. It looks like a photocopy. It's full of alien conspiracies, lizard men, and other crazy-sounding articles, like how the Loch Ness Monster is really an extraterrestrial seahorse. I thumb through a few issues before I read a headline that causes me to shiver. The Mogadorian race seek to take over Earth. The article is little more than a teaser of a bigger story that's going to run next month, but I can't find the next issue anywhere. I take a picture of the article and front cover of the magazine and send it in a message to Guard. He's going to flip out when he sees it. Maybe he can help me track down the people who wrote it, people who might know more about what's going on and how I can find Sarah. Guard responds quickly. Guard.
Whoa.
Jolly Roger 182. I know. Can you find anything else out about the mag? I grab a few loose CDs lying around the desk, just in case they've got any files of interest on them. Unfortunately, I don't see any kind of computer. Either Sam took it with him, or someone else has already made off with it. With a stack of magazines under my arm, I head out of Sam's room and through his house, glancing at pictures of his family that line the walls. Sam's dad is in some of them, staring back at me through thick glasses that look a lot like the ones Sam always wears. I barely remember Malcolm Good from school parties and stuff when I was a kid. I look down at the pile of crap I'm technically stealing from his son's room. Sorry, I murmur, and then head to the backyard through the back door this time. Outside, I freeze. There's movement in the woods near the end of the yard. I think about running, but if there isn't anything there, that'll cause me to look more suspicious. Just as my palms start to sweat nervously, an owl flies out of the woods. I exhale, telling myself that's what I must have seen. The side of the house casts a shadow that I disappear into, pressing myself up against the vinyl siding. I stand there for what feels like a long time, watching the road, trying to see any movement or lights, anything that might suggest that there's a black sedan ready to run me down. But there's only the breeze and the sound of birds and insects somewhere out in the woods. Finally, I start back to my truck. I'm silently congratulating myself on a job well done when I realize the only thing that means is that the crazy person who was after us the other day was, in fact, after Sarah. That she's probably being held captive by them right now. Or worse. Chapter 14. I stay up most of the night sending pictures and scans of the magazines to Guard. He works his internet magic and comes back to me with several phone numbers for the people who publish They Walk Among Us. He asks if I want him to call, but I take responsibility for it. I'm the one who's now pored over every column and every issue Sam had, hoping that something, anything, will give me a clue as to where the people holding Sarah might be. Or if not them, where John and Six and Sam might have escaped to. If I can find them, they can use their superpowers to rescue Sarah, no problem. No problem. I repeat this over and over in my head, hoping that eventually I'll believe it. I buy a burner phone after school the next day and start in on the numbers Guard came up with as I drive home. The first three I call have all been disconnected. Not a good sign. The fourth and final number connects, though. Actually, it rings forever with no voicemail. After about 20 rings, I hang up and call back. I count 20 more, and then I hang up and call back again. I've never been one for subtlety. After the third ring, someone hangs up the phone. I can hear the muffled sound of a split second of connection. So someone's there. I take a chance and call back. This time the pickup is immediate.
What do you want?
The voice on the other end of the line is shaky and high-pitched. It's a man's voice. By the rate of his breathing, it sounds like he's hyperventilating. Hi, this is... I fumble for a second before landing on a name.
Roger. Whatever you want, Roger, you've got the wrong number. Don't call back.
I'm just trying to get some info on They Walk Among Us. Are you one of the writers or editors or whatever?
I said you had the wrong number!
Click. The voice on the other end is gone. I slam my fist on the dashboard and try to figure out what to do next. Then I say, screw it,
and dial back. This time the man sounds pissed when he answers.
Don't call again!
My friend is in trouble, I blurt out. There's silence from the other dude, so I continue. She's missing. It has something to do with the Mogadorians. I just want to find her. I just want to know that she's okay. I sink back into the driver's seat, letting my head hit the rest behind me. Please, I say. There's a long sigh on the other end of the line. When the voice comes back, it sounds like the guy's crying.
We don't publish the newsletter anymore. They've taken everything. What more do you want from us? What more do you want? They've taken everything!
Who's they? I ask. But I can guess. The Moogs? Did they get to you? There's no answer on the other end. I take the phone away from my ear and stare at it for a moment before hanging up. I shouldn't be surprised that this was the fate of the magazine. Hell, I'm surprised anyone was left alive at all. I message Guard about the conversation, then I make a proposal. Jolly Roger 182. The people who subscribed to They Walk Among Us knew about the Moogs. It was in their mag. Guard. Right, we know that. Jolly Roger 182. We should change the name of our blog. Make it easier for true believers to find. Guard. You want us to become the new TWAU? Jolly Roger 182. I think it might help us find some new recruits, and the more people in on this, the more chances I have of figuring out what happened to Sarah. Guard. It'll make us even bigger targets if the Moogs shut down the old TWAU. Jolly Roger 182. But you are a computer whiz, untraceable addresses and IPs. I'm not worried. Guard. Let's do it. I'm emailing you an encrypted file. Password is a sea monster's planet. I know exactly what he's talking about. This morning before I left for school, we'd made fun of an old article I found in They Walk Among Us about how sea krakens come from the planet Shlongda. It was maybe the first time I'd ever got a hint that Guard had a not-so-serious side. Now that Sarah's gone, he's kind of the only person I can talk to about everything that's going on. I know I haven't met him in person or even talked to him on the phone, but he seems like the smartest person I've ever met. The things he can do with a laptop and internet connection blow my mind. And when I get home and open the file he sent me on my computer, I am nothing less than astonished. I'm staring at a text file that lists a ton of information on Agent Purdy. Not things like his bio or what he's working on, but numbers that hold a much different power. Telephone numbers, bank accounts, passwords. I message Guard. Jolly Roger 182. How the hell did you get all this? Guard. I'm an internet wizard. Guard. Oh, and I'd print that out and then delete that file. It was never here. Jolly Roger 182. Can you get into his email and stuff? Guard. I'm trying, but it's all intranet stuff. Heavy, heavy firewall. Lots of stuff offline, too. Jolly Roger 182. What if we had his work computer? Jolly Roger 182. Would one of these passwords open it? Guard. That's a different story. Guard. Wait. Are you about to do something really stupid? I've been dying for a way to take action. I guess I just found it. Chapter 15. Before I leave Nana's, I put a few notes on my desk. If I'm caught, there's a chance I'll be shoved into a black van and never see the light of day again. That's how the FBI and Moogs work, right? If that's the case, I don't want my family thinking that I ran away because of them or something. I want them to know that I didn't just abandon them for no reason. And if possible, that they should probably get out of paradise, too. This town is getting too dangerous. I leave a separate note addressed to Mom, telling her I'm sorry I haven't called and that she should bring Dad and Nana up to Cleveland. That way they'll be together and out of Moog Central. I hope they don't have to read the notes. I set up an automatic blog post, too, with my draft from earlier on what had really happened at Paradise High. If I don't log in and adjust the post time, if I get taken away, it will go live in a week.
Maybe others can learn from what I knew. Maybe they'll be able to find Sarah if I can't. I park my truck in an alley near the station where I can just see the front doors through a chain-link fence. There are a couple of agents milling about inside, but that's all I can see. I message Guard, who is acting as a diversion for me, calling one of the phone lines the FBI has commandeered and reporting to whoever answers, that a teenager with glowing hands and the power to move things with his mind just entered a truck stop outside of town. Whatever he says, it must be convincing, because the agents fly out of the station, jumping into their black SUVs and disappearing down the dark streets. I wonder briefly if Dad's being called in. I hope he's in good enough shape to put himself together if he has. An agent stays at the front desk, but I've figured out a way around that already. There's a window in the men's bathroom with a latch that's been broken since I was a kid. I remember once a rookie cop locked himself out of the station and got stuck climbing through it. But I'm more athletic than he was, and after crossing the street and skulking around to the side of the station, I'm bracing my arms against a porcelain sink as I pull the rest of my body inside, careful to close the window as softly as I can with my foot. I'm in. Now I just have to stay hidden. I walk out into the hallway where the bathrooms and some closets are and peek around the corner. There are a few rows of desks between me and the agent at the front, who seems glued to a computer screen. Dad's office is across the station, 20 yards away. Just two first downs, I tell myself. It's a cakewalk. I'm halfway across the station when my dad's office door opens. It takes half a second for me to slam onto the floor and roll under a desk, where I hold my breath and try to fight off the trembling in my hands. I must have been fast enough, because the two men who walk out of the office don't stop talking. "I'm telling you, the situation here is under control," a man's voice says with a slight wheeze. "My agents are..."
If things were really under control, Four couldn't walk in and out of this backwoods town as if it was his own private warship,
the other man bellows, his voice like a bass drum.
"I never should have left Paradise to someone who couldn't handle it. From now on, my soldiers will be taking over here."
I flatten myself on the floor and press my face up against the bottom of the desk, which offers me an inch or two of room to see through.
"That's not necessary,"
the wheezy man says. His face is pink and piggish, with a big, busted nose that looks like he's been tackled one too many times. I recognize him from the photo Guard and I had found online. Purdy. At least that means Dad's office is empty if they leave. If they stay, well, I'm completely screwed. The other man is a behemoth. He's at least 7 feet tall, with jet black hair pulled into a ponytail that disappears beneath his black coat. From the back, he's a wall of a man. A mountain.
"Your usefulness wears thin, Purdy," he says. "Don't let it wear out completely."
The giant of a man takes a step forward, then pauses. He turns his face to the back of the station towards me as if he's heard something. The man's eyes are almost completely black. They reflect the buzzing fluorescent lights overhead. I'm looking at a Mogadorian. I'd recognize those terrifying black eyes anywhere. I don't breathe. If I could stop my heartbeat, I would, in order to keep him from discovering me. But he turns away, barking at Purdy.
"Take me to number 4, he says.
He means John, I think. I've only got a few minutes before they realize the report is a sham. As soon as the station door shuts, I roll out from under the desk and tiptoe across the room. Fortunately, the agent at the front desk is trying to make himself look as busy as possible, and he types loudly on the keyboard, giving me at least a tiny bit of noise cover. Luck stays on my side. My dad's keys still work. Once I'm standing in Dad's office, I allow myself a second or two to exhale and get my shit together, though the fact that I almost got caught and probably just saw a high-ranking Moog is hard to get past. The office has changed quite a bit since I was in it last, when Dad was dragging me out the night John was taken in. There are a few big boxes sitting in one corner that look like they're full of all the files and papers that used to litter the place when it was my dad's. The desk is tidy now, compulsively so, which is great for me because it means less to sort through.
I take a seat in the chair behind the desk and rifle through some of the papers and files. They don't tell me anything. It's all memos and bulletins that are the kinds of things that go up on the FBI website. Public information. I'm looking for something a little more secretive than that. Purdy's laptop is sleek and black, like something out of a spy movie. I open it up while removing a piece of paper from my pocket that's got all the things Guard found written on it. Sure enough, the computer is password protected. I type in the one Guard pegged as Purdy's main access code, and just like that, I'm in. I'm on an FBI computer. God bless you, Guard, I whisper. The desktop is littered with files. At the bottom of the screen are a few applications. I open up Purdy's email, figuring if anything, it might be the easiest way of getting info on Sarah. The first password Guard handed over is a bust, but the second one gets me in. I type Sarah's name into the search bar so fast that I misspell it twice. Finally, it goes through, bringing back over 50 emails containing her name. I shudder to think how many times my name might pop up in these emails, but that's not what I'm here to find out. I sort through the newest ones first until I hit the jackpot. Detainee Hart has been transferred to the facility at Dulce. Dulce. I recognize the name immediately from back issues of They Walk Among Us and old posts on the blog. It's a name that pops up all the time, a secret government base where weird stuff is supposedly always going down. A small-scale Area 51. Sarah is being held in Dulce, New Mexico, half a country away. I have to go to New Mexico. I start looking through other emails when I hear the station door slam shut, followed by a string of curses from what sounds like Purdy's voice. Shit. Sitting in front of me is a wealth of information, maybe enough to change the tide of the battle between the Lorik and the Moogs, a battle that will decide what happens to Earth. I was hoping to have more time on the computer, then just to sneak out and let Purdy think I was never there. If I leave now, I can try to find Sarah and figure out what else is going on between the FBI and the Moogs on my own. But if I take the computer, if I steal this FBI laptop, maybe I can be the hero. With Guard's help, I can crack everything on the hard drive. Who knows what all we might learn? Sarah can help once I've saved her. If this laptop has good intel on it, maybe I can save everyone. And wouldn't Sarah be impressed by that? Fuck it, I say, pulling the power adapter out of the wall and taking the computer under my arm. As Purdy berates the agent at the front desk, I unlock one of the windows to Dad's office and slip out. In a flash, I'm in my truck shooting through the alley. I take one last look at the station as I drive away. Purdy's still in the front. Good. Maybe I'll have a while before he realizes what's happened. Just enough time to leave paradise. Chapter 16. I have breakfast in a diner a few hours outside of paradise. A steaming pile of pancakes and two sides of bacon. I was never a big coffee drinker, but I'm on my third cup. I need to stay alert and awake. I've got a long drive ahead of me. Between bites of pancakes, I spin my burner phone on the table. My actual phone is sitting somewhere on the side of the road outside of paradise, completely wiped clean of all my personal files and run over by my truck. All the info I need is on my burner now. I'm concerned about Sarah not having my number if she tries to contact me, but I can't risk anyone tracking me. Besides, I still have email, and I plan on emailing her every day until I see her again. I'll have Guard figure out how to block my IP address or bounce my emails off a satellite or something. I've already canceled the automatic blog post. It will remain in my drafts folder for now. I'm not ready to come out with all this information. Something tells me I may need to save it for later, when it can be used more strategically. I thought about calling my family and trying to explain myself further, but I can't risk it. They won't understand, and giving them any info about where I'm going or what I'm doing is dangerous for them. I just hope that they aren't too upset. With any luck, Sarah and I will be back in time for prom.
assuming there is still a prom. Assuming there is still a paradise. The diner's pretty empty. The sun is only just starting to rise in the distance, but I'm still cautious. I wait until the old man in the booth behind me leaves before I pull out the laptop and open it up. I'm not even sure where to begin. Maybe it'd be best if I just mailed the damn thing to guard. No. If anything on here will help me find Sarah, I need the info now. More than just the town she's in. I need to know how I can help her. I flip through some emails, mostly full of terminology I don't recognize. I tell myself that over time I'll analyze every word in these correspondences. There seems to be problems between the FBI and the Department of Defense, and I rack my brain to try and remember anything from my American government class about what it is the Department of Defense does other than something vaguely related to keeping the country safe. There are also a bunch of references to a secretary who's helping out the Moogs, but I don't know why Purdy's so interested in some office assistant. After a while, I take a break from emails and start looking around for information in other places. I start clicking around on the computer's desktop. One folder stands out to me. Moog Pro. Moogs. I double-click the folder, but instead of opening up like it should, a password terminal flashes on the screen. No username request, just a password field floating on top of the desktop. I try to escape from it, or click on one of the other files, but it blocks me from doing anything else. I pull out the list of passwords guards sent me, and try out the one that got me into the computer. A small red X appears below the password field. Okay. I try the next one, and end up with another red X. As I hit enter on a third one, it dawns on me what the X's probably mean.
Oh no, 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 no,
I whisper. But it's too late. I've fucked up. A third X appears, and suddenly there's a whirring from inside the computer as the hard drive spins into overdrive. In the background, I see files disappearing from the desktop. Finally, the screen goes black. The power button is unresponsive.
No! I shout. Son of a bitch!
I slam my fist on the table, rattling my dishes. The sparse customers at the diner all turn to look at me. My waitress hurries over.
Everything all right over here?
She asks, with a little more annoyance in her voice than worry.
Yeah.
I say, pulling out my wallet. I just lost my homework. I start to hand her my debit card, but pull back before she can take it. I've seen enough crime shows to know I shouldn't be leaving a trail. Instead, I hand her a 20. I wonder if it's already too late for me to hit up an ATM, if doing so will bring a horde of FBI agents choppering in from the sky. I'm fuming at myself when I walk outside and think about chucking the laptop in the air and kicking it into the parking lot. But it may be useful still. I'm only just learning about all this computer stuff. Maybe Guard can still get something off the hard drive. Maybe even info that'll help the Lorik and the rest of the world if the Moogs one day decide to invade on a massive scale. I get in my truck and pull onto the highway. There are hardly any cars in sight. The sun's at my back. My eyes are bloodshot from all the coffee, but I'll be fine. Better that than to be falling asleep on the road. After all, it's another 20 hours until I'm in New Mexico.
Chapter 1. There was once a place that was beautiful and lush and full of life and natural resources. Some people lived there for a long time, but then others came along who wanted or needed the land and everything on it. So they took it. There's nothing special about this story. Open any history book on Earth, and probably every other planet, and you'll see a version of it play out continuously, on loop, over and over again. Sometimes the land is taken in the name of spreading a better way of life, or for the sake of the native people. Occasionally the takers seize it based on some intangible reason, some divine right or destiny. But all of these reasons are lies. At the center of every conflict is power, and who will wield it. That's what wars are fought over, and why cities, countries, and planets are conquered. And though most people, especially humans, like to pretend that gaining power is just an added bonus on top of whatever a conflict is supposedly about, power is the only thing that anyone is really after. That's one great thing about the Mogadorians. They don't really bother with pretense. They believe in power, even worship it. They see its potential to grow and serve their cause. So when you're someone like me, who has extraordinary abilities, you become one of two things to the Mogs: a valuable asset, or an enemy who will eventually be destroyed. Personally, I like being alive. The Mogs don't pretend that they took my home planet of Lorien, which I barely remember, for any reason other than because they needed its resources. It's the same reason they're on Earth now. A planet as big as Earth will serve the Mogs well for decades, maybe even centuries, before they have to go looking for another home. And the humans, well, it's not like there's anything really special about them. They're pretty weak for the most part, and are only barely managing to keep the planet alive as it is. One day soon, there will be a full-scale invasion, and all their petty problems won't mean anything, because suddenly there will be some incredibly powerful extraterrestrials lording over them, showing them how to live, giving their lives purpose. And I'll be one of their new rulers, because the Mogs have seen the potential in me. They've promised me a spot as a commanding officer in the Mog ranks, with North America as my kingdom. My personal playground. And all I have to do is fight alongside them and help them capture the other guard remaining on Earth. Then I can help the guard see that there's no way the Lorik are ever going to defeat the Mogs. I'm assuming they were spoon-fed the same stories Ray, my Saipan, told me when I was growing up. That the Mogs were our enemies. But that's not true. Or at least it doesn't have to be true. Not if we join them. After sitting around training and waiting for almost my entire life, it feels good to finally have an actual mission. To have a purpose. To not just be hiding and waiting for something to happen to me. It makes me actually want to train and study and get better. Because what I'm working towards now isn't some fairy tale Ray fed me over dinner on the island, but a future I can see. I've learned a lot about the reasons why wars are fought and won in the last few weeks since I've been living in a Moog compound somewhere in the middle of West Virginia. In fact, most of my research hours are spent in an interrogation room that's been converted into a study for me, where I learn about famous battles and conflicts, or read the Great Book, which is the story of the Mogadorians, and how their intellect and abilities outgrew their planet and forced them to seek other worlds to rule and guide. About how the Lorik refused to share their resources or listen to reason when it came to adopting the Mogs as rulers. It's a book written by Satrakis Ra, the unstoppable leader of the Mogs, and, well, let's just say if I'd read it earlier, I would have had a much clearer viewpoint of the fight between the Mogs and the Lorik than I did when I was hiding in a lean-to shack on a deserted island. I've begun to wonder if all my memories of being so young and happy on Lorien are just because I was too dumb and little to know what was really going on. I mean, any civilization that puts their last hope in a bunch of toddlers on spaceships has got to be a little bit out of whack, right? Ethan's helped me see these things. He's helped me realize that I have a choice in this war, even though the elders didn't want me to have one. It was strange at first to find out that my best friend was working for the Mogs, and that I'd technically been under Mog care for the better part of a year without knowing it. But I can't blame Ethan for keeping things a secret from me at first. I'd been so brainwashed by my Saipan stories of the guard triumphing over the armies of the Mogs and returning Lorien to its former glory that I probably wouldn't have seen reason if he'd been up front with me at the beginning. Ethan is what some of the Mog commanders here have called a rare example of a human who has the intelligence to side with the winning team. Still, it's so strange to be here underground. I'm technically an honored guest of Satrakis Ra, but I haven't proved myself yet. All they have is my word that I'm now loyal to them. But words don't carry a lot of weight with the Moogs. They believe in action and results. And so I study and train, and wait for the day when I get the chance to show them I am capable and ready to lead in their name. I follow orders, because even though someday in the future I'll become invaluable to the Moogs, right now I'm just a former enemy living under their roof. I'm buried in a book about the founding of America, particularly the expansion of European empires across the country. When Ethan comes into my study, flashing the toothy grin he always has plastered on his face. "Good afternoon, Five," he says. "Hey," I say, closing the book in front of me. Ethan's arrival means study time must be over. As much as I'm looking forward to being in charge of Canada and the United States, reading about the endless cycles of wars they've been caught up in can be monotonous. At least once the Moogs take over, war will be a thing of the past. There'll be no armies capable of standing up to them.
How did you find today's reading?
There was some pretty dirty biological warfare going on back when Columbus and other explorers were first coming over. Smallpox blankets? It's kind of insane. Ethan's grin doesn't flinch.
The beginning of every great empire is stained with a little blood, he says. Wouldn't you say it was worth it?
I don't answer immediately. Ethan's eyes shift almost imperceptibly, but I catch them. He's glanced at the one-way mirror at the other end of my desk. It's easy to see what he's getting at. Others are watching. Here in the Moog compound, someone is always watching. I tense up a little. I'm still not used to being under constant surveillance. But it's necessary, as Ethan's explained, so that the Moogs know they can trust me. It makes me only want to say things that will impress whoever's watching, or show off how smart I am. I'm getting better at keeping my brain focused on that. Definitely, I say. Ethan nods, looking pleased.
Of course it's worth it. Keep reading that book tomorrow, and write down a few positive things about the Conqueror's tactics.
Whatever our beloved leader requires of me. I say this almost as a reflex. The first few days I was here, I heard it so many times that I just kind of adopted it. I probably say it 10 times a day now without even realizing it half the time.
Did you read the assigned passages from the Great Book? Ethan asks.
Of course. Those are the best parts of the study sessions. This is completely true. The other books are boring and make me suddenly understand why teenagers like me were always complaining about homework on TV shows I saw before coming to the Moog compound. But the Great Book is, well, great. Not only is it written much simpler than the other books, it also answers a lot of questions I've had throughout my life. Like why the Moogs went after Earth even though they had Lorien, and why they started hunting down the Lorik once they got here, even though there were so few of us. The book explains that the Lorik were weak, but sneaky. And the Mogadorian belief that leaving even one enemy alive gives them the power to recruit others and multiply, gain power and one day rise against you. Also, it's really bloody and violent, which makes it much more fun to read. I can see it play out in my head like one of the action movies I used to love to go see when I was still in Miami.
And what did you learn about today? Ethan asks.
About how Satrakis Ra bravely fought our elders, how they tried to trick him and poison him. But our beloved leader was courageous and bested them anyway.
Our elders?
Ethan asks, slight concern on his face. I correct myself. I mean the Lorik elders. It makes me even more excited to meet our beloved leader. I have not had the pleasure of meeting Satrakis Ra in person yet. Apparently someone higher up thought it wasn't a good idea to give a super-powered guy like me an audience with the future ruler of the solar system until I've proved myself. Ethan grins and pulls something out of his pocket. He tosses it on the table, and it bounces heavily a few times and then rolls. I stop it with my telekinetic legacy and lift it in the air, a steel ball bearing almost as big as a ping-pong ball. "What's this?" I ask.
"Consider it a gift. Use your power on it. See how it feels. I float the ball over to the palm of my hand. With a little focus, my body suddenly takes on a metallic sheen. I drum my fingers on the table in front of me, and the sound of metal meeting metal fills the air. Ethan calls this externa, the ability to take on the properties of whatever I touch. It's the newest of my abilities, and the one that probably needs the most work. I shrug as I crack a metallic knuckle. It feels like I'm made of steel. But I could have just touched the table and gotten the same kind of effect. But the table's not going to be with you all the time. From now on, this ball bearing should be. I don't want you to find yourself in the middle of a fight with nothing but sand or paper to turn into. Thanks, I smile. It's definitely not the flashiest or most expensive thing Ethan and the Moogs have given me, but I can see how it might end up being useful. I shove the ball bearing into my pocket, where it settles beside a red rubber ball I've carried with me for a long time. A trinket from a kid's vending machine. Ethan tosses me a rolled-up sheet of paper. I push some books out of the way and spread it out in front of me. It's a map of the Western Hemisphere. What's this for? I ask.
I just wanted to make sure we had all the information correct on it. For record-keeping and stuff like that.
The map includes a thick red line that zigzags across the United States and down into the Caribbean. There are dates printed along the markings. This is a map of all the places I lived growing up, I say.
Correct. Just give it a once-over when you have a chance. I guessed on a lot of the dates based on stories you'd told me.
But what good is any of this information? Ethan shrugs.
Just in case the guard somehow caught your trail or tried to track you down, we'd know where they might be searching. We'll want to put a few scouts in those locations, just in case.
I nod, looking over the map. It's weird to think of myself as being young and powerless with Ray in all these places. Ethan comes up behind me and looks over my shoulder.
Where was it that you said your guardian started to get so ill? He asks.
I point to a place where the line dips into Pennsylvania. Around here somewhere, I'm not sure where exactly. We were camping in the mountains. Ethan scowls.
There are some of the finest hospitals in the country in that area. You know, if your Sepan hadn't forced you to stay hidden on the island for as long as you did, he probably would have lived, Ethan says. It's a shame he was so short-sighted that he couldn't see the inevitable future of Mogadorian progress.
He thought the warmer air would help him.
What he probably needed was a shot of antibiotics.
Ethan shakes his head and crosses his arms.
I'm just glad you were able to get off the island before you ended up going crazy and talking to the pigs. I still can't believe someone as powerful and smart as you was expected to raise those slop-covered animals.
I laugh a little. Over the last few weeks, I've told Ethan basically everything I can remember about my life. All about the tiny little shack and the pigs I raised, and how I trained myself to use my telekinesis on my own. He and the other Moogs seemed really impressed by that part. Like I managed to become something great, even when every card in the deck was stacked against me. When I look at Miami on the map, my mind flashes with memories of the time I spent there before Ethan took me in. When I was just a punk-ass street rat wasting my powers on petty stuff like picking pockets, totally oblivious to how much authority I should have been wielding. There was a girl, Emma. My partner in crime who turned on me when she saw what I was capable of, who was afraid of what I could do instead of respecting my abilities. I frown at the memory, and my stomach drops a little because it's been a while since I've thought of her. There had been a time when she was my only friend in the world. But she was just using me too, wasn't she? I was the one with the real talent. She was just riding on my coattails. There's a knock on the door, and then a Moog enters, one of the Vatborn messengers and servants in the compound. I straighten up in my chair. This is a reflex. Even though I've been here a few weeks, I'm still getting used to seeing Moogs every day. More than that,
I never know what they're going to ask me to do when they show up in the interrogation room that's been turned into my study, or track me down in my bedroom. For all I know, they could be telling me that I've failed some test of theirs I didn't even know I was taking.
You weren't responding to your radio,
the Moog says to Ethan, clearly a little ticked off. Ethan points to the little earpiece that's hanging out of his collar.
Of course not, he says. All of your superiors know that I never wear my earpiece when I'm with our guest.
He motions to me. It would be rude.
Commander Deltok requests your presence in the detention wing,
the Moog says.
I'll be there at once.
Ethan nods.
You and the Lorik.
I tense up. What do they want from me in the detention wing?
Is that how you would address an honored guest in this base? Ethan asks. How about sir?
The Moog seems a little apprehensive, but nods his head to me.
Sir,
he says.
Dismiss him, Ethan says to me.
What? I ask.
You're going to have to get used to giving orders at some point.
I look at the Moog, who's got a full-on grimace now. I suddenly feel awkward. I hate it when Ethan does this. He's always trying to make everyone on the base treat me like their king or something. And while I'll be leading them one day in the future, I'm still unproven potential. And the last thing I want is anyone stirring up animosity against me.
Five,
Ethan says. You're dismissed, I say. The Moog hesitates a moment. I assume his orders were to escort us to the other side of the building. I can almost see him trying to figure out who outranks whom in his head before Ethan clears his throat and, in a flash, the servant is gone.
Conflicting orders, I'd imagine,
Ethan says as if he could read my brain. Do you think I'll get him in trouble? Ethan's face goes serious.
You can't worry about that. Don't forget who you are. When the Moogs take Earth, you'll be one of their officers, a leader. You may be new here, but you are the powerful number five. Show them mercy now, and they won't respect you when you're in charge.
I need a chart to keep the ranks all straight in my head.
Just always act like you're at the top of the food chain. Now come along,
Ethan says, motioning towards the door.
Let's see what Commander Deltok is up to with the prisoners this afternoon.
He doesn't give me time to react, only turns and heads out the door. I can't help but glance to the wall across from my desk, where a photo is taped up. It's a guy who looks like he's a few years older than me, with long brown hair. He's built like an athlete, way fitter than I've ever been in my life. He looks smug. He's jogging in the photo, and seems to be unaware that his picture is being taken. I haven't met him yet, but I know he's here on the base with me, locked up. They've tried to torture him, but that doesn't really work. He's protected by magic, like I am, by a charm put on us when we were kids that keeps us from being hurt until our number is up. He is number nine. The Moogs want me to kill him. His is the blood that must be spilled for me to advance. He is my proof of loyalty.